outlet.org. This is NPR.
And these are the stations of listener-supported Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. Coming up next, our Tuesday and Thursday public affairs show, The Bridge. Then at 9:30, Dig in the Dirt with your host, Ann Goldin. Her guests this morning are Joni Chappell and Nancy Leonard. We'll hear about the peak harvest season and about winterizing the garden. That's on Dig in the Dirt just one half hour from now. The board and staff of Tillicum Foundation, operating the stations of Coast Community Radio, thank you and these donors of thank you gifts for your support during our summer pledge drive. Seaside Brewing, the Inn at Manzanita, Seaside Factory Outlets, Moxie's, and Lyle's Pets. Today's forecast for the Columbia Pacific region, partly sunny with a 30% chance of showers, highs around 70 degrees, currently at 63 degrees here in Astoria, and the time is 9 o'clock. Welcome to The Bridge, a twice-weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. This morning, we'll hear about building and rebuilding lives. After Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans 8 years ago, many people packed up what little they had left and started afresh, well away from the Gulf Coast. One of those families settled in Oregon. We'll hear how one of their children is faring in the long process of readjustment. Also on the show, we'll hear how smoke from western wildfires is having a beneficial effect on fish runs. Then Julie Sabatier has the story of some modern homesteaders and how they grow or make most of what they use in daily life. This is Coast Community Radio. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. In top regional stories this morning, newly released documents show that for at least 6 years, drug agents have had near immediate access to billions of phone call records dating back decades in a collaboration with AT&T that officials have taken pains to keep secret. The program, first reported yesterday by the New York Times, is called the Hemisphere Project. It's paid for by the federal government, and it allows investigators armed with subpoenas to mine the company's vast database to help track down drug traffickers who frequently switch cell phones to avoid detection. That's a different approach from that of the National Security Agency, which has come under fire for maintaining its own collections of call records. The Associated Press independently obtained a series of slides detailing the Hemisphere program. They show the database includes not just records of AT&T customers, but of any call that passes through an AT&T switch. Investigators who request searches of the database are instructed to, quote, never refer to Hemisphere in any official document, close quote. Here are some traffic impacts in Astoria this week due to the combined sewer overflow project. Work will continue on 8th Street between Grand and Lexington this week. Sewer and storm pipe will be installed between Irving and Lexington. 8th Street will be closed to through traffic in the area. Intersections will likely be open to east-west traffic when construction is not underway. Construction on 9th Street will continue between Duane and Harrison. The road will be closed during construction. Street grinding is scheduled for next week, along with pipe work between Exchange and Grand. On 11th Street, grinding is scheduled on 11th between Exchange and Irving. Short-term road or lane closures may be necessary. On 12th Street, between Exchange and Jerome, some short-term road closures may occur. And CenturyLink will continue working on Exchange between 7th Street and 8th Streets. The city has been informed that the majority of their effort through mid-September will be focused at the intersection of 7th Street and Exchange. Washington State residents will be able to start the process of buying insurance through the state's health exchange next month, but many likely still have a few questions about insurance options. A Spokane-based toll-free customer support line started taking calls at 7:30 this morning. Potential customers will have a live person to talk to about plan choices, costs, and what kind of subsidies they might be eligible for. The toll-free number is 1-855-9-2-3-4-6-3-3. The call center, which will be staffed by 80 people, will be open from 7:30 a.m. till 8 p.m. Monday through Friday. The plans that will be part of the exchange are expected to be voted on by the board of the Washington Health Benefit Exchange this week. Employees who were destroying nerve gas and other chemical weapons at an Eastern Oregon plant knew all along that the chore and their jobs would come to an end. Clint Schumacher started at the Umatilla Chemical Agent Disposal Facility a dozen years ago when he was 19. He says he knew it was a temporary position, but that knowledge didn't really click at the time. The East Oregonian says Schumacher began looking for a new job about 6 months before his August 1st layoff. He's found limited options for jobs that would pay what he'd been making. Since completing destruction of chemical weapons in late 2011, the facility has cut almost 700 jobs. There are 165 employees left. Three climbers were injured when they fell into a crevasse on Mount Rainier. King TV reports the climbers fell 50 feet about 3:30 a.m. yesterday at Emmons Glacier. The climbers, all Canadian, were rescued by helicopter after another climbing party found them yesterday morning. Two of the climbers were critically hurt and taken to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle. A third climber was taken to another hospital. No other information was immediately available. In southwest Washington, Cowlitz County Superior Court officials say too few people are showing up for jury duty, causing criminal cases to be delayed. The Daily News reports three cases were delayed in August, one of them for only half a day, after too many people ignored their jury summons and the jury pool didn't contain 12 acceptable jurors. Sue Anderson is the jury management clerk in the Cowlitz County Superior Court Clerk's office. She says people skipping jury duty have been a problem for some time now, but it seems to be getting worse. Superior Court Judge Stephen Warning says it's a misdemeanor to ignore a summons for jury duty, but few courts, including those in Cowlitz County, enforce the law. The only moose herd in Oregon appears to have doubled in size in recent years, despite deaths in recent years from a parasite. The Oregonian says the herd numbers about 60 animals today, compared to 30 in 2006. The carotid worm problem was discovered in about 2010 when biologists captured a moose in Wallowa County to fit it with a radio collar. The moose died as it was being captured. The worms were found during a necropsy. The moose are the smallest subspecies in North America, with females weighing up to 800 pounds and males weighing up to 1,000 pounds. Alaska and Yukon moose are the largest subspecies in North America, weighing about 1,500 pounds. The animals migrated into northeastern Oregon decades ago from Washington State's Spokane-Pullman region. The state of Oregon has ordered a Portland bar to pay up in a case that involved alleged discrimination against a group of cross-dressing men. Some in the transgender community say this type of treatment is far from unusual, correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
The case involved a Portland watering hole known as the P Club, which has since changed its name to the Twilight Annex. The owner phoned members of a cross-dressing group that met there occasionally and told them they weren't welcome to come back. The Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries investigated. The club was ordered to pay $400,000 to members of the group. It's the first such payout under a 2007 state law that bans discrimination based on gender or sexual orientation. Portland transgender therapist Reed Vanderberg says such blatant discrimination isn't that common, but it shows up in other ways.
Oh, sideways looks when you walk in, slowness of service, being asked for your identification in what seems like a more overt or challenging or mocking kind of way.
Vanderberg says he thinks things are getting better, thanks in part to the anti-discrimination law, but he says few people seem to know about the law, even those who have been discriminated against. I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
This summer, wildfire smoke has hung over local communities for weeks at a time. Some scientists have noticed surprising benefits. Smoke shields the sun and lowers water temperatures, perhaps improving conditions for spawning salmon. Jefferson Public Radio's Devin Schwartz explains the benefits of smoke on the water.
It's a rarely told story how wildfire smoke helps cool rivers and streams. One of Will Harling's first memories is the 1977 hog fire in Northern California. He says the fire burned the forest behind the cabin where he was born. 10 years later, an even larger fire caused air and water temperature to drop below 60 degrees.
That was the first summer we didn't even want to swim in the river because it was so cold.
Now executive director of the Mid-Klamath Watershed Council, Harling says wood smoke deflects sun rays and lowers the temperature of water. Picture those silver reflectors in your windshield that keeps your steering wheel from melting. Harling says salmon were dying in the Klamath River tributaries earlier this year, but when two large wildfires ignited, the water cooled and fish death slowed. In other words, fire may have temporarily saved salmon through a smoke inversion.
In addition to stopping more spring chinook from dying, lower water temperatures from the smoke inversion triggered fall chinook to migrate up the main stem Klamath River and into tributaries.
Harling says cooler water convinces salmon to swim upstream from the ocean and seek spawning grounds. Taz Soto is lead fisheries biologist for the Karuk tribe. He says fires near the Klamath River have dropped the water temperature by about 10 degrees. 10 degrees can make a big difference for fish, and that change is partly because of wildfires.
One positive thing that's come out of all these wildfires, it's cooled off the river. The media rarely talks about positive things about fires, and that's one of them.
Smoke affecting water temperature and fish in a positive way? This is smoke so heavy, Soto compares it to fog. He says you can't see your shadow and the sun can't shine through.
It's a relief for the fish, but not for the people who have to breathe it in.
Michael Hughes directs Oregon Institute of Technology's Environmental Sciences program and formerly worked for the Klamath tribes. Hughes says that shade helps cool water, the most common shade being clouds, vegetation hanging over stream banks, or smoke. Volcanic eruptions are an extreme example. Hughes says major eruptions cause major cooling. Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines in 1991, and global temperatures dropped, bucking a warming trend. Hughes describes even stronger cooling effects caused by the Mount Mazama eruption, which created Crater Lake thousands of years ago.
It would have likely induced a global dip in temperature of a degree or two for a year or two.
Craig Tucker, Klamath coordinator for the Karuk tribe, says fire is also part of tribal ceremonies still held during salmon runs, when cold water is at a premium. So did Native American tribes use fire to help cool the water and support spawning salmon? Or was this an unintended consequence? Again, here's environmental scientist Michael Hughes.
For them to realize or to think that that water temperature was stressful to the fish would be, I think, a really profound piece of information.
Craig Tucker says cooling caused by Native American fires may be more than a coincidence.
A lot of the religious practices of the tribes are also natural resource management practices. And so for a long time, government agencies thought that the tribes were just pyromaniacs setting fire to the landscape, but now they're realizing the wisdom and using fire as a management tool.
Watersheds have evolved around natural fire cycles, and Taz Soto of the Karuk tribe says fire provides more benefits than drawbacks. He says more research is needed on how smoke affects water temperature and salmon spawning. There may be unexpected connections between the two. I'm Devin Schwartz reporting.
Nature has the power to destroy and to heal. 8 years ago, Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast, hitting New Orleans especially hard. One family made the difficult choice to flee their place of birth for a new life in Oregon. The eldest daughter has had a difficult time adjusting and finding her way. This summer, she and her younger sister enrolled in a 5-week job training program in the woods with the Northwest Youth Corps. Angela Kellner brings us Holly's story.
On a hot Saturday in July, anxious parents drop off their apprehensive teenagers at the Northwest Youth Corps headquarters in Eugene. Inside the gym, the teens clutch their belongings, including new work boots still in the box. Crew leader Ben Thayer goes over the basics, making sure they aren't overpacked.
You'll be supplied with 2 work shirts. That'll be what you're wearing most of the time. The most important things are your boots, your socks, your pants, and your work shirts. Does everyone have work gloves?
The group hustles outside in the blistering sun, where the baby steps of team building begin. They're shown a large white wall tent that's already set up and given the pieces of another to assemble.
So does everybody want to grab a leg?
They'll be sleeping in these tents for more than a month. It will be their responsibility to set them up and take them down when they move between job sites each week.
Three, one, two, three.
Boom.
Northwest Youth Corps sends crews to rugged locations across Oregon, Washington, and Idaho every spring, summer, and fall. The U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management are the two largest agencies that hire the NYC crews. Students can earn credit. Everyone earns a stipend. 19-year-old Holly Looper plans to use her stipend to pay for a trip back to New Orleans, where her family left 8 years ago.
We left before the hurricane hit because we lost two homes before that, so we didn't want to be there for the hurricane.
But on the way to a safer life in Oregon, Holly was nearly killed.
A 20-pound piece of metal came off a semi and went through my dad's windshield. I actually moved in time to put my arm in front of my face. The pressure broke my arm.
They have family in Oregon. Her mom attended Oregon State University. She worked at Hynix, a semiconductor plant in Eugene, and was laid off when it closed. Her dad is disabled. Holly graduated from high school and can't find a job. Her family is pinning a lot of hope on this job training program for her and her younger sister. She says the last several years have been tough.
We always are striving for that home, like finding a place to call home. And so we're doing this because we don't want to rely on my parents because it's financially hard. Like, luckily with this program, I was able to get a scholarship.
Holly wipes tears from her striking blue eyes, her face framed by blonde hair with a pink streak dyed down the middle. She's larger than all the other teens on her crew, and she knows the fieldwork will be physically demanding.
I'm a big girl, and I'm not the most physically fit person, so that's what I'm hoping to achieve, like become more fit and be healthy for myself.
Holly's mom, Patty Looper, is a college graduate and has a good job. She wants the same for her daughters. She doesn't want Katrina to win.
My daughter Holly was a all-star baseball player. And then we almost lost her when we came up here for Hurricane Katrina. So, you know, she gave up a lot. Although she's a great kid, she gave up on her self-esteem, I feel. She would never tell you that.
Along Highway 38, east of Reedsport, is Spruce Reach Island. It's home to the Howard Hinsdale Garden, sprinkled with rhododendrons from around the world. It's open to the public only one day a year, when the flowers are in full bloom. The BLM now owns it. BLM botanist Jenny Sperling says it was terribly overgrown until the Northwest Youth Corps came in.
4 years ago, this garden was solid, head high with blackberries. You couldn't walk through it. And the first year, we had the kids just cut it off and haul it out. And they came back with a vengeance, so we said, oops, we better start digging them out. And they've done a terrific job.
So now that you see where the root is, This is going to take pushing and digging and pushing until you get all the way to the bottom of the root.
Okay.
Kneeling down in the shade, pulling weeds by hand is Holly Looper, happy and smiling.
I'm starting to like it here. More and more every day.
Holly says it's been difficult to be away from her family, but they came out to visit and brought jambalaya for everyone. By the second week, Holly wanted to quit and go home. That's what happened to her younger sister. Crew leader Ben Thayer says Holly toughed it out.
We didn't let her quit. We pushed her through those. We had some talks, and she has made monumental strides. She's always keeping everyone super positive, and she's now one of our better hikers, whereas before she would get in her own head and keeping herself back, but she's too smart to be the only person standing in her way.
Holly says she's made 9 new lifelong friends and gained appreciation for the outdoors.
When I get back, I'm totally going to recommend this to a lot of my friends. You can go from being someone who doesn't do anything to someone who's just like got all their stuff together. I went from not doing anything to like wanting to do something.
She wants to move to Eugene with her boyfriend. She plans to enroll at Lane Community College and study to become an ultrasound technician. I'm Angela Kellner reporting.
Still coming up, it's been almost 40 years since the Homestead Act was repealed, but the desire to live off the land and grow or make most of what you need hasn't gone away. We'll hear about a family in Clackamas, Oregon, where the tradition lives on in what they call an urban homestead. That story coming up at 9:24. You're listening to The Bridge. It's now 9:21. I'm Kathleen Morgame with Northwest News and Weather. The recent case of two missing children from Washington has raised fresh questions about the Amber Alert system. The brother and sister from Pierce County were located and are safe, but their disappearance did not trigger an Amber Alert. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins explains why.
The siblings were allegedly taken by their mother, who has supervised visitation rights but not custody. Family members reported the mother might be suicidal. Police considered the children endangered and in the past might have issued an Amber Alert that would have flashed across TV screens, radios, cell phones, and highway billboards. But Bob Calkins with the Washington State Patrol says now there's another option.
We would like to see the Amber Alert reserved for those most egregious cases where we know a child is in extreme danger.
Like the recent case of Hannah Anderson, who was rescued in the mountains of Idaho after being abducted in California. Police in Washington now have an option that's basically one step short of an Amber Alert. It's called an Endangered Missing Person Advisory. It allows for some but not all of the Amber Alert notifications to be used. As of now, Oregon and Idaho have not formally adopted this additional option. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Today, partly sunny with a 30% chance of showers, highs around 70 degrees with southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour shifting to the southwest this afternoon. Rainfall amounts today less than a tenth of an inch. Then tonight, mostly cloudy, a 20% chance of showers with overnight lows 55 to 60. Tomorrow, another mostly cloudy day, a 20% chance of showers, highs in the high 60s, and then on Thursday, showers likely with a chance of thunderstorms in the morning, a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon, highs on Thursday around 65 degrees. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. It's been almost 40 years since the Homestead Act was repealed, but the legacy of self-sufficiency and living off the land continues today. Destination DIY's Julie Sabatier visited some modern-day Northwest homesteaders. She has this story about people who grow and make most of what they need in everyday life.
Goody and Carol Jones are what you might call old-school DIYers.
Well, when we grew up, DIY was called making do.
She's 66 now. Carol and her husband Goody live just outside Salem, Oregon. They're both fascinated by primitive art and tools. In the summertime, they conduct workshops on early living skills. And Goody has an impressive collection of clothing made from hides he tanned himself, as well as arrowheads, baskets, bowls, and other stuff he's made. But Goody doesn't just use these skills for a few weeks in the summer. He's a year-round maker.
I broke a handle on one of my spoons the other day, so I forged out a new handle for it.
Goody has a forge behind the outdoor kitchen on the property he and Carol have shared for the past 17 years.
Where I do a lot of iron work and things of that nature.
I said, we work as a team. Goody can make almost anything, but I'm like the artistic director.
Real quick, the greenhouse back here is almost 100% recycled material. That's where I start a lot of my plants that we'll live on through the year.
Even though they make more than they buy, Carol says she doesn't identify as a modern-day homesteader.
If we were younger, homesteaders are awesome people, but that's going back a little too far for me. I don't want to start from zero again. To have every single part of every single day be work, something that you had to make or do yourself.
Well, she's right, but what is life if not work?
Rebecca Vinson is half Carol's age, and she lives with her husband Nick and their three kids on a small homestead in Clackamas County, Oregon.
I don't know if it's a homestead. We call it an urban homestead because I don't know what else to call it.
President Lincoln signed the Homestead Act in 1862 as a way to encourage westward expansion. The new law allowed any U.S. citizen to claim 160 acres of government land for a small filing fee. After 5 years, homesteaders could qualify for ownership of the property, provided that they lived on the land and improved it by building on it and planting crops. The law was repealed in 1976, but the concept of homesteading stuck around, and it's still associated with self-reliance. That's how the Vincent family interprets it.
It was exciting. We woke up this morning and we came out. We found a new mama who had hatched 10 little baby ducks. And ducks actually are perfect for Oregon homesteading. We do have chickens, but ducks are so well adapted. They love the rain. They come out and dance in the rain.
There are ducks, chickens, goats, and turkeys.
9-year-old Stella was holding an unruly chicken that chose that moment to flap its way out of her arms. That might be why she forgot to mention that they also have geese and rabbits. Many of these animals will eventually become food for the family. And the Vincents do a lot of their own butchering. 13-year-old Josh says that took some getting used to.
Yeah, it was a lot harder when we were younger. Like, the first time we butchered a lot of chickens, we accidentally got one of my favorites in there. And yeah, that was kind of sad.
The kids sometimes complain about all the extra work they have to do when they get home from school. But Stella says she wouldn't have it any other way.
And it's really fun doing this lifestyle because, like, we get more out of life than if we just are couched potatoes.
The Vincent family and others like them are proof that a simpler way of life is still possible. I'm Julie Sabatier.
That's all for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs Tuesday and Thursday mornings at 9. On Thursday's show, we'll hear about a startup company that promises to reduce the upfront capital cost of upgrading municipal sewage treatment plants. The cost savings could be a boon for small rural communities struggling to adhere to increasingly stringent regulations. Tom Bonsi reports how the startup, Blue Array, plans to save small towns some money and make money at the same time. Thanks for listening. We welcome your feedback on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. Let us know what you think, and please let us know about story ideas you'd like us to take a look at. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.